The Spectator magazine is home to wonderful writing, insightful analysis, and unrivaled books and arts reviews. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online, along with a free £20 John Lewis or Waitrose voucher. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to Spectator Out Loud. Each week we choose some of our favourite pieces from the magazine and ask their writers to read them out loud. I'm Patrick Gibbons, and on the podcast this week, will Sadiq Khan lose London? James Heal suggests that, despite the opinion polls, rising discontent with the Labour mayor could make May's election closer than we think. Madeleine Tian argues that babies with Down syndrome have a right to be born. Reporting from Jerusalem, Tanya Gold updates on life in the city as Israel's war enters its seventh month. And William Moore reveals what he has in common with Kim Jong-un. Up first, James Heal.
With Labour 20 points ahead in the national polls, a lot of Tories have already written off next month's mayoral contest in the capital. London, they maintain, is a Labour city that occasionally votes Conservative. But supporters of Sadiq Khan and his Tory challenger, Susan Hall, agree it's going to be closer than many think. Three factors are held by both camps to be at play. The first is the incumbency factor versus time for a change. Khan's re-election team has consulted other campaigns, which won three in a row. All agreed this was the hardest contest to win. A hat-trick eluded Ken Livingstone, who lost in 2008, despite nearly a decade of prosperity for the city. Khan boasts a less impressive record. Half the capital's residents say in polls that he has performed badly or very badly on knife crime, gangs and homelessness since 2016. One pollster tips him to underperform his party by up to 10 points. In these times, remarks one GLA candidate, the only incumbent certain of re-election is Mr. Putin. This leads to the second reason, an expected rise in split ticket voting, with many Londoners backing the Tories in May before switching to Labour later this year. One Tory candidate tells of a typical doorstep encounter. "I'm going to smash your party at the general," said the voter, "but I'll back you in the mayoral to get that man out." The mayor's image is as likely to be found on Conservative leaflets as Labour, with some in Khan's own party choosing to airbrush him from their messaging. In Wimbledon, the Hall campaign was met by one voter furiously tearing up one of their leaflets because they saw Khan's face on it, only to realise, belatedly, it was from the Tories. Campaigners report continued anger with the expansion of the ultra-low emission zone. "Cab drivers used to complain about their wives and girlfriends," remarks one. "Now they moan about Sadiq Khan." Much as Mrs. Thatcher was dubbed TBW, that bloody woman, by her third election campaign, so too is Khan often now referred to as that man on certain London doorsteps. Low turnout is the third factor making this election competitive. The five previous mayoral contests in London have seen turnout range from 34 to 42%. A figure towards the lower end of this range is expected to favour Hall, given the strength of feeling from anti-Khan voters. He enjoys a large but passive and unenthusiastic potential vote share, while Hall's potential vote is smaller but more likely to turn out. "If it's less than 35%, Susan wins," says one Tory Assembly candidate. "If Khan gets more than that, he does." Added to the mix are a series of electoral novelties, mandatory voter ID, restrictions on postal votes, and the voting system change from the traditional two-round first preference system to a straight one-off vote. Both candidates have an interest in presenting the contest as a two-horse race, as Khan illustrated literally with a Barnett Stables photo shoot. Khan's campaign, socially liberal, environmentally progressive, unabashedly Europhile, is aimed squarely at convincing the 15% of Londoners tempted to vote Liberal Democrat or Green. Rob Blackie, the Lib Dem candidate, who's earned the nickname Bionic Man for his titanium neck, installed after he was violently mugged, has struggled to shift the dynamics of the contest. Labour are thus turning their attention to the yellow stronghold of south-west London in places such as Richmond and Kingston. "They don't have an insurance policy anymore," says one Khan ally. "That's why we're asking them to lend us their votes." The Greens, who have finished third in the last three contests, and their pink-haired candidate Zoe Garbett, are likely to be less pliable. The Green growth is going to be the big thing, predicts one rival candidate in Islington. But an early call for a Gaza ceasefire and the absence of a Corbyn-style independent candidate means, in the words of polling expert Lord Hayward, Khan is likely to avoid a Muslim backlash. Hall, by contrast, is focusing on the Londoners perceived to have been ignored by Khan, older voters, the more socially conservative, and the self-employed. Many of these comprise the 1.5 million city residents who, like Hall, backed Leave in 2016. Hall aims to meet 100,000 voters in person by polling day. In her office proudly stands a map of the capital, marked off with pins after every visit. Some Tories fear her time is being wasted trying to convince individual voters on the doorstep. "But listening to Londoners is a very good use of your time," retorts one supporter. It's exactly what Sadiq Khan hasn't done. Ads bearing this message on a pro-hall Facebook page have been seen 3.5 million times since February. Between 20 to 30 staff are working on Hall's campaign, run from CCHQ in Westminster. Her team wants to deliver 3 million leaflets by 2nd of May, with some of their best feedback coming from traditional Labour voting council estates. Conversely, wealthier areas such as Kensington can be more challenging. One Assembly candidate was greeted outside a £5 million house in Camden by a woman throwing a shoe at her head. Overshadowing the mayoral race is a general election. This is the first time both contests have fallen in the same year. Keen to keep up his winning record, Keir Starmer and his aides have worked to patch up relations with Khan after what one aide conceived was a difficult summer. On the ground, activists in various parties report squabbles between GLA candidates and MPs fighting for leaflet space and canvassing sessions. It is a little bit brutal out there, says one. The results will yield invaluable insights for party strategists in national headquarters. The Tories will look nervously at the Essex border, where they worry Brexit voters may be abandoning the party. For Labour, it will be a test as to whether the fears of voter ID really do impact their base. As for Reform, with its candidate Howard Cox, this unpromising territory offers a chance to see whether their polling translates into actual votes. Far from being a write-off then, the mayoral contest could be the more interesting of the two elections fought this year, and potentially more competitive too.
That was James Heal. Next, Madeline Tian.
Many of us remember at least one morning in our childhoods when fate threw us some unexpected twist and we knew instantly that life would never be the same. Mine came in July 1991, 2 months shy of my 5th birthday. I had just received the news from my aunt that my mum had gone into labour overnight. My siblings and I had a new sister. We were gleefully baking biscuits that morning when we heard my father's car on the drive, returning from the hospital. But someone almost unrecognisable walked into the kitchen, shell-shocked, with a ghostly pallor. Something was wrong. Today, hundreds of women in the UK will discover they're pregnant. Those who choose to keep their baby will be offered a blood test, usually at their 12-week scan. This will reveal how probable it is that their child has Down syndrome. For some women, the results of that test will cause them to end their pregnancy. Abortion is legal in the UK for up to 24 weeks. The 1967 Act also states that abortion up to birth is permitted if there is a substantial risk of abnormalities which would render the child seriously handicapped. Around 90% of babies found to have Down syndrome are believed to be aborted in the UK. Given the mounting evidence that the Downs community is facing erasure, the law has recently been challenged in the courts by Heidi Crowter, a young woman who has the condition. Crowter's case was rejected by the High Court and Court of Appeal, but now Sir Liam Fox MP, a committed advocate for the rights of those with Down syndrome, has tabled an amendment to the Criminal Justice Bill supporting it. This amendment would prohibit abortion on the grounds of Down syndrome after 24 weeks gestation. In 2021, there were 24 such abortions, up from 14 the year before. Fox told The Times he has considerable cross-party support for the move. I sincerely hope he succeeds. On that day back in 1991, my parents were told that my sister Anna had Downs and were asked by the social worker if they would be taking their new daughter home. But who could have told them what we all know now? The arrival of my younger sister was not, in fact, a tragedy. It is one of the best things that ever happened to any of us. I am not claiming that there haven't been difficulties, but having a sibling with Down syndrome changed my own life irrevocably for the better. Anna also has a rare form of epilepsy, and she has never managed to walk or talk due to brain damage. Yet, I can honestly say that my sister has taught me more than any Cambridge professor or Dominican priest about life's biggest questions. With no mobility, she is still the strongest and most resilient person I know, who has maintained a quiet dignity while enduring many physical challenges. If there is any glimmer of goodness within me, it is mostly down to Anna. She has inspired me to see the world in a radically different way. I have witnessed what a truly supportive marriage is through observing my selfless parents caring for her. It might sound trite, but thanks to their example, I know what true love really is. And what about Anna? What about her quality of life, you might be yelling? The honest answer is, I don't know for sure. She cannot tell me. but I do know she is enveloped with love. What I also know is that we cannot legislate for the total eradication of suffering, and it would be dangerous to try. Consider, for example, that we are still in a situation where around 40 babies are aborted each year in the UK for having a cleft lip or palate, even after Joanna Jepson's brave attempts to highlight this travesty. If we permit this injustice for a minor abnormality, which can be corrected with surgery, is it any surprise there has been no progress regarding the rights of unborn babies with Down syndrome? At this point, you might be wondering, am I some kind of religious nutjob wading into the abortion debate? Well, I confess that I'm a Catholic. But when it comes to abortion, I'm not here to present a religious case. Whatever your religious or political persuasions, when the vast majority of Down's babies' lives are terminated, it strongly suggests that this is not just about choice. Rather, it is about a devastatingly irreversible choice in particular. Let's not forget how often we hear that able-bodied, bright and beautiful teenagers are dangerously unhappy, their mental health in tatters. Thank God we can't see into the future when we conceive our kids, otherwise we might choose to have none. But this isn't about God. The likes of Crowther are speaking out on behalf of themselves, not the church. I'm writing based on my own experience of having a sibling with Downs. The UN Committee on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities, which is supportive of abortion in general, has even recommended that the UK update its law on abortion so that it no longer supports legalising selective abortion on the grounds of fetal deficiency. Fox is offering MPs the chance to abolish a law which allows a whole category of people to be extinguished, even up to birth. In cases after 14 weeks, this means allowing the insertion of forceps through the cervix to remove the tiny baby. The status quo is not a victory for choice, but a tragedy for the diminishing Downs community. MPs have a rare opportunity to fight for the survival of their fellow human beings. I only hope they will be brave enough to do it.
That was Madeline Tian. Now, Tanya Gold.
Israel has a new train line, 25 minutes from Ben Gurion Airport to Jerusalem. The Christian pilgrims would love it, but they're not here. Instead, there are soldiers and visiting American Jews. My taxi driver says American Jews come with thousands of dollars of cigarettes and drive around looking for soldiers to give them to. He says American Jews love Israel more than Israelis. Then he moves his machine gun, it's on the front seat, and says, "Welcome to Israel." The American Jews go south to the massacre sites of the 7th of October to stare at the bullet holes. I don't. You can't forget the war here. At the airport, you are greeted by photographs of the hostages. They are up in windows and on street corners. Some say, "Bring them home now," an anti-Netanyahu message. My cousin says that when the war began, Israeli women coped by baking. Soon the message came back from IDF commanders. No more cakes, just cigarettes. I date my trips to Jerusalem in the falafel sandwiches you can buy near the Damascus Gate, where the road splits like history, left for the Dome of the Rock and the Wailing Wall, right for the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. The souk is sullen, angry. A 12-year-old Palestinian boy was killed by an Israeli police officer in East Jerusalem the day before for holding a firework. Itamar Ben-Gvir, Netanyahu's coalition psychopath, praised the police officer. It's Ramadan, and Hamas have asked the Palestinians to rise up. But they haven't. They pray at the Dome of the Rock. Later, the restaurants fill up. One is called the Peace Cafeteria, local prices. Another Holy Land Pizza, in Pizza We Crust. Another the Holy Bagel. God has been a certainty here for 3,000 years. And a commodity. This is a city of competing realities, sometimes of competing drafts of the same reality. They all want Mount Moriah, holy limestone. Adam was created here, Isaac was bound here, Muhammad began the night journey here. The Holy of Holies is probably under the Dome of the Rock. Is this why the prophet Isaiah invented the Jerusalem of the mind, which William Blake ripped off? For peace, of the mind. If Isaiah can't cope, where does that leave us? The competing realities are explicit. Ultra-Orthodox Jews dress for 18th century Poland. They haven't noticed the change of climate. Arab Israelis dress for the British Mandate and George V in exquisite mid-century suits. Christians dress for the Black Death or earlier. On the roof of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, I meet a man dressed as Jesus Christ. He is from Ohio, and he sleeps here. Souk traders are usually the happiest people you'd meet, but not now. Tourism is 80% down. A trader tells me there's no business. He won't talk of heartbreak to a British journalist, but he looks frightened. He thinks the war will last 6 months, though a Jew told me it isn't a war. Rather, it is a day, the 7th of October. The nun in the Christian Information Centre says they normally have 350 pilgrim groups for Easter, and they walk to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre the wrong way. The latest research says the Via Dolorosa wasn't Christ's roots, but the name still stands. There are plaques to more recently murdered Jews. This year, only 60 booked. The souk sells T-shirts to support Israel and Palestine, or more rarely, both. I find Winnie the Jew, Pick a Jew, Jewbacca, and an iPhone case with Greater Palestine drawn on it. Beggars stand on the steps by the mall under Suleiman the Magnificent's walls. I haven't seen such well-dressed beggars since Rome, where they sleep by St. Peter's, rise, dress, and walk off with their wheelie suitcases. They say it's the war, that's why they beg. I gave one a rug I bought in the souk. I paid £160. I paid £260 after the trader seemed to cry. It's the diaspora Jew tax, and it's more for women. We listened to a cellist playing Over the Rainbow by the Jaffa Gate. It was written by second-generation Jewish immigrants to America. For them, Over the Rainbow was America. I meet the patriarch in his Crusader-era palace near the Jerusalem Santa's Grotto, Ho-Ho Holy Land. He likes to vet all press requests personally. He blesses this piece. I tour the Holy Sepulchre with a priest. They're having work done, the floor is being replaced. Small diggers roll through Golgotha, and though I love this church, or rather, these six churches, one contested monastery and the Jewish graveyard beneath, I think of the omen. The priest shows me the midpoint between the Rock of the Crucifixion and the tomb. He says it's the centre of the world. I walk to Mount Moriah. Jews can enter between 7 and 11 a.m. by a foldaway wooden bridge above the Wailing Wall. I pass a 3-foot-high mezuzah, the largest I have ever seen. No prayer books, England, says the police officer. No touching, no dancing, no prayers. I follow a Jewish religious sect. We have an armed policeman each. They lie on the floor before they enter, facing the spot of the Holy of Holies. A Jewish woman asks me, what will the Third Temple look like? I reply, the Holy Land Experience in Florida. On the mount, the Jews long to pray. They inch towards the Holy of Holies. The Muslims ignore us. Third Temple woman tells me Christianity is Judaism without the rules. I tell her it's Judaism without the certainties. As we leave, we pass the Golden Gate. I was obsessed with it during my childhood. It is, an exquisite metaphor, sealed until the Messiah comes.
That was Tanya Gold. Finally, William Moore.
North Korea has a problem with Alan Titchmarsh's crotch. Last week, a 2010 episode of Garden Secrets was aired on state television, but the network blurred Titchmarsh from the waist down. The offence was his gardening trousers, a pair of jeans. For the Workers' Party of Korea, jeans represent an invasion of capitalistic lifestyles. They must be resisted. In a sense, Kim Jong-un is right that jeans are a sign of American dominance. In 1986, the philosopher Regis Debray declared that there was more power in blue jeans and rock and roll than the entire Red Army. Communist states agreed. Western-produced jeans were banned in the Soviet Union and Maoist China. The smuggling of bootleg jeans became so widespread that Soviet authorities gave it its own name, jeans crime. A single pair could be sold for as much as a month's average salary. In the mid-1970s, there were attempts in East Germany to manufacture state-approved alternatives to American jeans, but without much success. As one disgruntled reader wrote to Pravda, "When you can make jeans better than Levi's, that will be the time to start talking about national pride." Yet, when it comes to the idealization of jeans, Nothing can top country music. The association of jeans with blue-collar work and cowboy individualism is irresistible to many country stars, as spoofed by the comedian Bo Burnham in Country Song, brackets, Pandering. A cold night, a cold beer, a cold jeans. The strongest example of sincere jeans worship comes from Zac Brown in his 2003 song Chicken Fried. He cites a pair of jeans that fit just right as one of the things that American troops fight and die to protect. Giorgio Armani said that jeans represent democracy in fashion because anyone can wear them. But is that true? Jeans have been part of the uniform for every Western youth culture movement of modern times. Skinheads and hippies, rappers and punks, goths and hipsters. But there's an unsettling feeling when you see someone in their off-duty jeans, like bumping into your teacher at the weekend. In 2018, researchers from Collect Plus made the unverifiable claim that 53 was the maximum age someone could get away with wearing jeans. The truth is that while age, attractiveness, and politics may all be factors, who can and can't wear them is an instinctual judgment. Ronald Reagan could wear jeans, Richard Nixon couldn't. Confession. I don't own a pair of jeans. I once told this to a Montanan cowboy. He looked at me as if I told him I don't own a toothbrush. Unlike Kim, my dislike isn't ideological, it's visceral. Jeans may be timeless, but their different iterations are not. I blame my prejudice on the style that was popular when I was a teenager in the early 2000s. Then, the fashion for boys' jeans was big, baggy, and deliberately ripped, worn so they hung around the thighs. I was inoculated against them forever, like a bad oyster. Still, while I don't own a pair, and I'll keep to corduroys and chinos, I'm grateful jeans exist, because they led to some nifty innovations. For instance, jeans were the first trouser to feature an amazing hookless fastener, or, as it was later renamed, a zip.
And that's everything for this week. If you enjoyed those articles, why not pick up a copy of the Spectator magazine to read them and many more in full? I'm Patrick Gibbons, and I hope you join us again next week.